Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of Next Witness, Please. We're a podcast that decodes legal jargon and procedures into everyday terms for just regular folks. Our goal is to build public understanding of the law and our legal systems. I'm retired Judge Tom Hodson, and I'm joined by my co-host, retired Judge Gail Williams Byers. And today we're going to talk about the arrest of State Trial Judge Hannah Dugan in Wisconsin by the FBI. She allegedly helped an undocumented immigrant leave her courtroom to avoid being arrested in the hallway by ICE agents. Was this a strong message from Trump's federal agents or an assault on the judiciary? We'll talk about it. Judge Gail, this is a fascinating case. I've got all kinds of feelings about this, but let's just start off with some facts.
Facts help. Sure you do. I thought about this case and I said, oh my goodness, we're going to have a conversation about this and we've got to keep it to an hour.
Okay. So Judge Dugan was on the bench. She is a Milwaukee County Circuit judge. She had a defendant in front of her who was charged with three counts of assault, allegedly beating up his roommate's girlfriend and her cousin. But he also was a target because he was an undocumented immigrant who had been deported at one time. His name's Eduardo Flores Ruiz. He was deported at one time earlier, came back into the country, and had been in Milwaukee for about 12 years, working as a cook. Had no criminal record until this incident. So that's the background. What happened was six ICE agents came. They were out in the hallway. An attorney told the judge, hey, there's some ICE agents out there. She allegedly said, this is absurd. Quickly went off the bench, went out, confronted the agents, told the agents that before they could do anything, they had to talk to the chief judge. So they go down the hall, at least some of them go down the hall, talk to the chief judge. The rest of them stay out in the hallway. The chief judge says, hey, you know, we're working on a policy about this, but you have to stay in public places. Meanwhile, Judge Dugan goes back in, gets on the bench, goes through the case, whatever the hearing was for Mr. Ruiz, and says, you know, there you can go out to this jury room door, which goes into a private area of the courthouse. But to get out of the building, you have to go through the private area, then into a public area. So the attorney and Mr. Ruiz went out of there. A agent was in a public elevator with them, but didn't arrest Mr. Ruiz. Mr. Ruiz then took off running, and they ran him down, literally ran him down, caught him, and he is in custody. Next day, the FBI shows up at the parking lot as Judge Dugan was coming to work and handcuff her and charge her with two crimes. Federal crime of obstruction or pending federal immigration officers, and second, concealing an individual to prohibit his arrest. Whew.
That's a lot.
Two more quick things. Attorney General Pam Bondi quickly came out with a statement saying, this will send a strong message to judges who do not help the Trump administration. And Kash Patel, the new FBI director, actually did a perp walk photograph of Judge Dugan, and put it on his X account, saying, "This shows that no one is above the law."
I want to say it was placed somewhere on his social media, on the FBI's formal social media site. And what's more is after these showings from the U.S. Attorney General and the FBI director, Judge Dugan was then suspended from the bench by the Wisconsin Supreme Court pending resolution of her federal case. And so this is, I think, the beginnings of a very stressful and the continuation, perhaps, of a strained relationship between the judiciary and the federal administration that we've never seen before. Now, I think it's important for us to start by addressing maybe some of the contours of the incident itself. And by that, I mean, you know, and feel free to jump back in, Judge, anytime you right. want. But I think it's important to address some of the contours of this situation. And starting with the responsibilities, the obligations, and the province of a judge, a sitting judge, when they are faced with the execution of either a judicial warrant versus an administrative warrant. It also, I think, will be helpful for us to just define these for our audience so that they understand the difference and why judges respond that way.
Let me just add that Judge Dugan, when she went out to talk to the ICE agents, asked them if they had a judicial warrant. They said, no, they did not. They had an administrative warrant. So let's talk about the differences.
Indeed. So I'll take judicial warrant.
All right. You take that and I'll take administrative.
Okay. And so when a judicial warrant is issued, a warrant, and most people, again, may be confused by what the big deal is here, because the idea is, you know, perhaps a warrant is a warrant is a warrant. And that's not true. It's like saying a banana is a tangerine is a pineapple and also a bag of grapes. No, there are very distinct differences between judicial warrants and administrative warrants. When a judicial warrant is issued, it is a warrant to arrest or to require the appearance of someone or to bring someone into custody based upon a judge or a magistrate or a judicial officer making a very specific finding of probable cause. That probable cause standard answers two questions. The first is, was a crime or an offense committed? The second is this person likely the one who has committed that offense? Now, the requester, generally law enforcement, the requester of that warrant must provide some evidence or information. It is not evidence that is tested to the degree of beyond a reasonable doubt, but they must present to the judge or the magistrate or the judicial officer some evidence that supports a finding of probable cause. And therefore, if it is found or determined that those two standards are satisfied or those two questions are answered, yes, then that is when the requester, law enforcement, prosecutors, etc., are then vested or given the authority to effectuate an arrest in what is then considered to be a criminal matter. This is, again, something that undergoes judicial review. It respects the role of the judge as well as those requesting said warrant. And it also preserves the due process rights for the accused, providing them other opportunities subsequent to the issuance and effectuation of the warrant to come back to a court to actually test the veracity of that warrant. And that happens a lot of times as well. But a judicial warrant in and of itself is one that is underpinned by that process and assures the accused that they have had an opportunity to have this alleged evidence vetted or reviewed or determined by a objective judge who makes a determination as to whether or not to give law enforcement the authority to effectuate the arrest.
That's my... You're spot on. That's my interpretation of what a judicial warrant is. Now, an administrative warrant is not issued by a court. An administrative warrant is issued by an agency, and it asks federal officers to enforce an administrative order of that agency. So let me give you an example. Let's say that the agency person authorized to issue these administrative warrants looked at a list of 10 people and said, okay, these five we think are undocumented immigrants, illegal aliens, whatever you wish to call them. We want you to bring those people into custody. So we're going to give you FBI. We're going to give you ICE agents, especially ICE agents. We're going to give you a warrant saying that you can go out, find this person, and bring them into custody before we start any judicial proceedings. So it is a warrant to bring someone into custody, but it's not based on probable cause. It's not issued by a judge. And it was clear in Judge Dugan's situation that this was an important distinction. The court there in Milwaukee had already decided, although it hadn't been in a written policy, that they would allow the execution of judicial warrants in public places. Now, somebody might ask why they do it in a courthouse. Well, from a police officer's perspective, you do it in a courthouse because somebody's already gone through security and been vetted not to have a weapon. So they have said judicial warrants are good. Administrative warrants, not so much. And you can hang out in public place, but we're not going to give you access to private places in the courthouse, namely the courtroom or certain hallways. Is that a good description?
It absolutely is. It absolutely is. And for the reasons that you outlined, those kind of make sense, right? That if there is to be some kind of execution of this administrative warrant, then perhaps the best place is in a public place in a courthouse, because we know that, you know, it's probably safer. It's kind of controlled. The subject is not, you know, likely to get far if they attempt to run or to abscond. And they've already been wanted for weapons. So you already know that more likely than not, you are not only keeping law enforcement safe, you're keeping the target safe, but you're also keeping everybody else in the general vicinity safe. So there's, you know, less likelihood of hostage taking or someone being harmed with a weapon. It doesn't mean someone can't be harmed some other kind of way, but they're right. Not likely to be harmed with a weapon. But there's also, again, that important balance that is required to be made between, you know, the civil administrative warrant and the legal weight of that vis-a-vis a judicial warrant that has gone through the scrutiny of a judge.
Any judge anywhere will honor a judicial warrant. I would venture to say any judge anywhere, whether they're another federal judge, whether they're a state judge, whether they're a magistrate, would honor a judicial warrant because they know that another judge has looked at it and determined the probable cause necessary for that to be effectuated.
I'll even go as far as to say that when treated respectfully, and I think that does matter, right? There is a tenor and tone of respect that is also necessary to be employed when coming into a judge's domain. And their courtroom, their courthouse, and even the common areas, I think judges consider all of that to generally be their domain. You know, I would be inclined that any judge anywhere is probably not going to be satisfied with anyone else, whether they're a federal agent or anyone else, coming into their courtroom and disrupting their proceedings because they believe that their civil administrative warrant has or carries more weight than the judge's proceedings. And I don't care if this is a municipal or a, you know, circuit judge, or if it's a, you know, district judge or common pleas judge of a higher level. I don't think it matters. I think judges really are very protective of the area and the authority that they've been given to carry out their judicial functions. I think part of the problem here came, yes, with the fact that there is a civil administrative warrant for which, by the way, you know, the judge has no obligation to accommodate the federal agents. That just doesn't exist. Now, certainly, there is an argument to be made as to whether or not the instruction or the alleged instruction of the defendant, who I think we can pretty much agree, we're not talking about a choir boy. We're not talking about somebody who's has the most pristine record. But here's the other thing is he's also innocent until proven guilty. So notwithstanding whatever the allegations are, you know, you cannot just naturally assume that because he or she is in a courtroom that they are naturally guilty simply or only because that's where they're required to put their feet that day. But I think in this instance, this judge was particularly off put by the fact that you had agents who were attempting to essentially flex in what could be considered the judicial domain. Now, of course, there's the argument, Judge Hodson, that, you know, does directing them through a non-public door to take a route, allegedly take a route out of the courtroom that perhaps they normally would not have taken, that would not have normally been available to them, that is not generally available to any other member of the public, and was allegedly specifically created in this limited instance to provide a, you know, an indirect path to exiting the building that had perhaps not been used before, if that is where the rub is. But as you indicated, even if that were the case, you allegedly had ICE agents who rode the elevator with the defendant, had access to the defendant in public areas, could have effectuated a safe arrest just as they could have, you know, whether even if they were right outside Judge Dugan's doors. And nonetheless, you know, allegedly permitted the defendant to get some ways away before running the defendant down and then ultimately arresting them outside of the courthouse, which again is less safe. That I think is problematic.
Let me add here. I think the media, the news media, has done a terrible job covering this because they had just jumped to the issue. Was it a good arrest? Was she guilty? Obviously, she's guilty. She did all of these things without looking at the nuance, one, of factual situations, and two, case law. And I think this is a problematic case for the government, in fact.
Well, I want to make a plug here. I think this is exactly why more mainstream media outlets need retired judges
on
their shows to actually decode this, because I do think we do a disservice to the larger and broader society by not explaining to them what these nuances are, because we shouldn't just be so focused on clickbait or ratings or headlines without really educating people about what the contours of this was, because it might be this gentleman today, but it could be any one of them tomorrow.
Yeah. So let's look at the facts first as we know them. And of course, we know them through media coverage. We haven't read the police reports. But we've read the warrants. I've read the warrants. I've read all the material that's been made public on this. If the judge said you can go through this jury room door that went into a non-public area of the courthouse, there was no exit from that non-public area to the exterior. In other words, the person and the attorney could not go through the door to the non-public area and then go outside and be free outside the courthouse. That wasn't the way it was.
It would be like Judge Dugan running to her chambers and having to live there forever because there's no way to leave chambers without then going back to a public area to get out of the building.
So they had to go through the non-public area, get into a public area. So the charges are obstruction or impeding federal immigration officers, concealing an individual to prohibit his arrest. Okay, so I don't know about that last one because the Mr. Ruiz came out, had to get into a public elevator with his attorney to get out of the courthouse. That was accompanied by an ICE agent. Why they didn't effectuate an arrest right there, I have no clue. But it wasn't like she concealed this person till the ICE agents went away, and then he ran away and they caught him in a foot chase. They right. allowed him
hide in the jury room until they leave.
Yeah, they allowed him to get off the elevator. He then took off and then they ran him down.
But here's what's more to your point. If he's on the elevator, even if he went through a limited area that was not public, so he goes through a limited area that's not public, he has to at some point break a plane between the areas that are private versus the areas that are public. And once that plane is broken, even prior to leaving the building, yes, he has to be fair game at the time the plane is broken. So if it's the moment he steps off the elevator, if it's the moment he enters an atrium or hallway or a common vestibule, if it is as he's approaching the exit doors, all of those are considered public areas. And that means, just to your point, he's absolutely fair game at any of those points, notwithstanding or without regard to how or what path he used to leave the actual courtroom itself. There is no way, presumably, to leave the courtroom even through a non-public area such that you also leave the building through a same non-public area. That seemingly cannot happen. And because it didn't, and because you had ICE agents that were available to arrest him at any of those junctures, kind of seems like this is a challenging argument on the part of the government. And it seems more so for show than anything.
The government would have to argue that on the obstruction and impeding federal officers, that her allowing the person to go through the jury room door into another non-public area to a public area somehow obstructed or impeded the officer. I think that could be argued to the contrary, however, when the officer's in the elevator with him.
Yes. And so that I think you can probably expect that from her defense team to say you have the officers that are there. If in fact it was their intent to effectuate an arrest, whether they effectuated that arrest in the hallway right outside her courtroom doors, or if they effectuated in the atrium of the courthouse itself, which by the way, could have always been an option, right? If they always knew who they were looking for, they knew what time his hearing was, they could have set up camp in the atrium area of the courthouse. It appears that Mr. Ruiz did not know or wasn't aware that ICE agents would come there to collect him. So he was clearly signaled by the time they showed up to the courthouse doors. But if they had perhaps allowed the hearing to conclude the way that it normally would have, and for the court to have adjourned his case, perhaps the way it normally would have, and for him to then depart the courtroom and attempt to depart the courthouse with his attorney, he could have just as soon been arrested perhaps at the main courtroom doors, and it would have been just as equally a safe environment and public environment as it would have had it been right outside Judge Dugan's courtroom doors.
Well, if you recall, we talked about a few episodes ago an incident where somebody was on trial and came out of the courthouse and was arrested. The issue was, you know, you arrested someone in the middle of a trial, but that was outside in a public area. There was no question about it being inside the courthouse. Correct. You know, but the person had been vetted for security going in and obviously was safe and secure coming out if you grab someone immediately. And they did in that instance. That's different than Judge Dugan's situation. Totally different.
And I also think that, again, it's still, you know, equally safe to arrest or apprehend someone, even if they are, again, in a common area. And I think the Supreme Court has ruled on this, on what the appropriateness to arrest someone in a common area versus other places, and all of the benefits of doing that. And I'm sure you're gonna, you know, tick off the list all of the important decisions that have been made in this particular area. But one thing I do want to touch on so that I don't forget it, because I'm not as young as I used to be, is separate and apart from all that transpired with this. Again, I think perhaps the Attorney General Bondi believes that she and Director Patel are right-footed in this. And time will tell as this case, you know, kind of winds its way through. At the end of the day, though, I would say, in my personal opinion, in my personal capacity, as I am looking through this, I believe at the end of the day that the AG and the FBI were a bit heavy-handed. They were successful in apprehending and arresting Mr. Ruiz, who was the original target and intent. To then go back and to suggest that, or to say, or to act in a way that, you know, would be so heavy-handed with regard to a judge, where all of us are to some degree are on the same team. We're on the same law enforcement team. We want to do what's right, or should want to do what's right by, you know, everyone that goes through the justice system. I again, in my personal opinion, feel like the response was extremely heavy-handed, especially given, again, that the limitation of the authority was that to an administrative warrant and not a judicial warrant. And it clearly doesn't meet the same standard. What's more, and I think what's even more challenging, and I struggle with this, is after the arrest of Judge Dugan is effectuated, the fact that as lawyers, both AG Bondi and Director Patel then make public statements regarding the incident with the judge, who, by the way, is ethically barred from speaking about this case, not just because she's a party, but because the ethical rules that govern us require that we not speak about cases that are pending or impending, unless you're a retired judge like you and I and have a podcast where you could talk about whatever you want, pretty much. But for her, there are limitations. I am struggling to understand why, for the presumption, why AG Bondi and Director Patel do not believe these same rules apply to them. Because I really, quite frankly, believe that speaking so publicly about this pending case is just as ethically challenging as it would be if Judge Dugan had taken to the same networks and decided to do sit down interviews. And I'm surprised that they themselves do not, or would not otherwise, face some kind of disciplinary action.
Well, they won't. But it's just another example of bullying. You know, both of these statements from the AG and the FBI director were unprecedented. The FBI director does not put perp walks on his formerly Twitter account that now an X account. You just don't do that. And you don't put something on there that says no one is above the law. You know, you just don't do that.
Unless you mean it for everybody, including the executive branch. So if we're talking about the executive, the legislative, and the judicial branch, then
yeah, whether it's ethical or not, there you just don't pile on like that unless you want to send a message. Obviously, this was sort of planned in a way. Certainly, the public response was planned, and we're going to bully this state judge, and we're going to send a message so all other state judges out there won't give us any problem. So how do we do that? We make a public spectacle of it. That's what it does.
I just genuinely think it's in poor taste. Again, I don't have any issues with any branch of government executing the laws of this country under the authority they've been granted. But I also am a strong proponent that of all of us doing so and engaging in a way that is nothing short of the highest levels of civility and respect and deference to the separate but co-equal branches of government, and not engaging in is exactly what you said, kind of bullying and taunting. And taunting to the extent that, you know, statements like, hey, this is going to send a strong message to judges that don't help us. It also could, I'm not suggesting that it will, because I think there are plenty of judges that are like, you know what, then sign me up for the next arrest because I'm not doing it. But I think it could, and it is perhaps even designed to create what we call a chilling effect. And that chilling effect is, it is designed to make judges, every judge, think twice, to be chilled or to pause or to second guess or to disobey their better judgment and to look the other way and to just comply, because they don't want that experience for themselves. They don't want the embarrassment for their families and their colleagues. They don't want to have to go through this process. And again, you know, understanding that, yes, you very well have a media and a national media outlets that do not work to fully educate the public.
No, they go for the clickbait, which is the perp walk picture.
Yeah, they take the first and then make a decision based on that, and can actually taint prospective jurors. This isn't a foregone conclusion. I certainly, and I don't know about you, but I could see the Department of Justice just really, really standing firm, drilling down, refusing to dismiss the charges or whatever. I could see them, you know, riding this all the way through and to the end, which is perfectly fine if that is a case they want
to
bring.
I think they ought to have a better fact situation to do.
That would be helpful, right? No.
if we could get back to Judge Dugan's case in particular, you know, we talked about the factual situation. She's got a defense based upon the facts, but she also has a defense based upon the law that has not been talked about in mainstream media. It just has not been talked about. And there are at least three cases, federal court cases, that says that state and local officials, including judges, are not required to honor ICE detainers or administrative warrants. Administrative warrants.
The very kind of warrant that they had.
That's exactly what they had in this case. So I just to educate our audience, and that's what we try to do, let's just run through a couple of these, Judge Gale. The Galazara case, a Third Circuit Court of Appeals case, 2014. The court found that local agencies are not compelled to cooperate with ICE, and therefore they can be held responsible for violating an individual's rights when they act on a detainer that leads to an unlawful detention. So that what that case says to me is that's flipped. If Judge Dugan had done something to turn over Mr. Ruiz to the ICE agents. If she was the instrument of that, she could have been held responsible to Mr. Ruiz for his detainer.
Yes, and violating his constitutional rights.
Because it was on an administrative warrant, not a judicial warrant.
Which, again, lacked that very important judicial oversight and review and determination. So you're absolutely right. Like, that case wasn't decided all that long ago. 2014 is, what, 11 years ago? That's not such a long time ago. It tracks with Miranda Olivares and Clackamas County case also in 2014.
Well, there was a 2014 case, right? Miranda Olivares versus Clackamas County. It was a case in Oregon. Miranda Olivares alleged that she was detained in custody on an ICE detainer warrant, and she sued the county that was detaining her because it, again, was an administrative warrant, and the court held that she was being held without due process under the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, and she was the subject of unreasonable seizure under the 4th Amendment, and she was also imprisoned improperly under Oregon law. Well, that, again, takes the side of the detainee against, this time, not a court, but a county that was holding her and said, hey, you're violating her federal civil rights laws.
And mind you, this is under the, 1983, which is the Civil Rights statute.
Civil Rights Act.
Yeah. And the Civil Rights Act. Now, again, not sure how the Civil Rights Act now aligns with the current administration's interpretation and how
I'm
they
sure
will
it
enforce
doesn't.
The Civil Rights Act. But it's at least in 2014, rather, when this case was decided, you're absolutely right. There was the what we came to believe or understand as the traditional interpretation of the Civil Rights Act. What is an important pronouncement of depriving this defendant of due process. And we are probably going to need to devote an entire episode on just due process, what it is, how it's been interpreted.
I'm sure that's true.
I think there are so many questions under that because, again, remember, these are, you know, this is the key to the immigration problem that we're seeing or the issue with the mass deportations to El Salvador and other places without the benefit of due process. And that was one of the arguments here is that, again, the defendant, Miranda Olivares, was indicating that, you know what, by doing this, she didn't get due process. It violated the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. Fifth Amendment, which is, you know, freedom from unreasonable searches and seizures. I'm sorry, Fourth Amendment, unreasonable searches and seizures. And also, I mean, aside from the federal laws it violated, as you indicated properly, that it also said that it violated Oregon law, which was a false imprisonment. All of these things kind of collide. And I know that we've talked in previous podcasts about, you know, how the unpredictability, I'll say, of our U.S. Supreme Court. But I think one thing that kind of encourages me, especially on the issue of due process, which is so important, not just here, but in every single case. When we saw the Supreme Court rule a few weeks ago, although I don't know that I've seen sufficient response from the administration, but we saw this court rule unanimously that deportation of individuals that are alleged to be migrants to the United States and also alleged to be members of certain or affiliated with certain gangs shall first be provided due process under law. That was actually pretty stunning because I can name at least two justices that I would have been willing to bet donuts to dollars would never have agreed that this was a right afforded to anybody, much less individuals that are just merely alleged to be in the country illegally and alleged to be members of certain gang affiliated organizations. Now, I want our audience to understand, this is not, absolutely not me suggesting that I am in favor of violent gang criminals who are, you know, in our country illegally and have no other legal right or standing to be here. I'm not suggesting that they should be permitted to remain. What I am saying is, as the justice has said, and justice has been decided previously in cases, case after case, is that every individual is afforded and is owed due process under our Constitution. If you are here, you are owed due process, and it is not an attachment to citizenship that you are owed that. It is the mere fact that you have engagement with our legal process
that you're present in the country.
Yes.
Regardless of how you were present.
Regardless of how.
Let me just give a quick and dirty definition of due process. Due process is that you are entitled to the rights guaranteed you under the Constitution of the United States. And that is protection against illegal search and seizures, as well as other protections, protection against self-incrimination. All of those are what we call due process rights.
The right to counsel.
You're also entitled to the right to counsel under the Sixth Amendment and the right to a public trial. Mm-hmm. So all of these in the Constitution and the Bill of Rights encompass your rights, whether you're guilty as sin or whether you're innocent as an angel. Everyone has those same rights. And that's what we call collectively as due process rights.
Indeed. And I would absolutely agree that that is kind of the down and dirty of what due process is and what due process is designed to do. And as you said before, it is not limited. It is just by the mere fact that you are here in this country. There's no bearing, no connection or connectivity to your status as a citizen per se. But what it is a matter of you having engagement or intersection with our legal system that then confers these rights on you. You have these rights because of the fact that you are now engaged with and you have to navigate our legal system.
There's one more appellate case that we should mention. That's Gonzalez versus ICE. And that's a 2020 case from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is in the western part of the United States. And that case specifically says that the court found that ICE violates the Fourth Amendment. Now, Fourth Amendment is unreasonable search and seizure, in this case, seizure, violates the Fourth Amendment by issuing detainers based solely on database searches without proper probable cause, and by issuing detainers to law enforcement agencies in states that don't allow them to make civil immigration arrests. Now, translated, what does that mean? That means unless you have a judicial warrant with probable cause, you can be violative of somebody's constitutional rights under the Fourth Amendment if you help ICE or if you're an ICE agent and you execute that improperly. Would that be a correct definition?
That would absolutely be. Mm-hmm.
So we've got three cases, two from 2014, one from 2020, and all three of those cases are helpful, I think, to Judge Dugan. We don't hear about that in mainstream media, and that is unfortunate because, you know, people say, well, she's guilty. Look at the facts. Well, no, maybe not. Based upon the factual situation that we talked about and based on those three cases. But the final case I want to talk to you about, Judge Gale, is the Supreme Court case in 1997 of Prince versus U.S. That's Prince, P-R-I-N-T-Z, not Prince as in musician, but Prince versus U.S., 1997. And it said, this was an opinion written by Justice Antonin Scalia. Justice Scalia was the, before the current iteration, was the most conservative member of the court. He was a Federalist. He was an original intent person. He wrote this. The federal government may neither issue directives requiring the states to address particular problems, nor command the states' officers or those of their political subdivisions to administer or enforce a federal regulatory program. Now, breaking that down from my point of view, Judge, that says that a state officer certainly is a state judge, would qualify for that. And it says that they don't have to administer a federal regulatory program. Regulatory means administrative. It doesn't mean judicial. So if there's an administrative warrant, it's part of a regulatory program. And according to Justice Scalia, citing federalism and the 10th Amendment, that would be improper for a judge to, a state judge, to follow that.
Indeed.
Am I putting too much stock in that case?
I don't. I actually think that, you know, perhaps Judge Dugan's legal team should be reaching out to you.
Well, no, but perhaps. But Justice Scalia, I mean, he doesn't mess around with these things, given his track record as a Federalist and a fundamentalist on the Constitution and original intent. He's saying the federal government can't order a state officer to do something just based on an administrative warrant. If there was a judicial warrant, that's a different story. Because then you've had a determination of probable cause, and you've had the other term that we've talked about, which is due process.
Due process. Mm-hmm. And again, I think that these are so important. And as you said, you won't mistake Justice Scalia as some, you know, far-flung liberal
justice. He's not a liberal justice at all.
Not at all. Now, I don't think that at the time of the Prince decision, he could ever have imagined a circumstance like this one with Judge Dugan coming to pass with, you know, a conservative administration in place. Because think about it, generally, the consensus is that conservatives are just as tethered to a fairly strict construction of the Constitution as is Justice Scalia. And so that this seems kind of, you know, outside the normal bounds of what conservatism generally looks like. So it will be interesting when or if these arguments come back to revisit the justices, as well as some of these opinions and the specific writings of justices like Justice Scalia or Justice Thomas in being applied to these specific circumstances. I genuinely think, like I said, that seemingly awesomely offended by Judge Dugan's behavior on the day of this incident. And again, we're not talking, I don't think there's any suggestion, at least not from me, that Mr. Ruiz is a choir boy. But I think there was some pretty significant offense that was taken to Judge Dugan's response to the federal government's actions that day. And I think it led to kind of the heavy-handedness of the response. Because remember, even after Mr. Ruiz was apprehended, he was arrested and now is in custody, there had to be some kind of discussion, determination, and approval to then decide to issue charges against the sitting judge.
Oh, it was a Justice Department decision under Attorney General Bondi and the FBI Director Patel.
Absolutely. And so that's where I think the you know, potentially the heavy-handedness came into play is, you know, but I also do not know. And I think this is worth noting that for as easy as it is for us to have at least discerned whatever limited information is in the public sphere related to this case and compare it to the case law that is pre-existing, because this is the case law that's already here. We're not making this up, folks. You're welcome to look these cases up. Right. I think that AG Bondi and Director Patel may have benefited from somebody briefing this for them in advance of them making a final decision. Why is that? Because yes, some of this may be good, you know, media theatrics for now, but I don't think that this administration enjoys losing. I don't think that they enjoy, you know, perhaps being reminded or told that they are not on strong legal footing. And I think if in fact this is a decision that the AG and the director of the FBI are going to make, that they should make this with the full knowledge of what the scope of the legal landscape looks like. They should have been very familiar with these cases. Certainly they knew what the circumstances were, as had been told to them by the agents. And I'm sure it was, you know, all the agents are singing like a choir. So they're all telling and singing the same song and telling the same story. However, you have to be willing to be your own devil's advocate from the very beginning. You have to ask the hard questions from the very beginning, because yes, you can issue the charges, you can embarrass the judge, you can make a big scene about this. You can even go on certain networks and talk about a pending case, even though in my view, you should not. And in fact, I think it invites disciplinary action if you do, but you can do that. But at the end of the day, there's going to be a resolution. And if, in fact, from the very beginning, your case is on a three-legged stool and two of the three legs are wobbly, then it would appear to me that you or somebody trusted around you might want to encourage you to pump the brakes. Because the arrest of Judge Dugan was literally the day after the arrest of Mr. Ruiz, which kind of signals to me that maybe nobody took a beat, that, you know, they didn't really digest everything that happened. Or maybe, I don't know, maybe they were briefed on it and they know as much as we know and that we're explaining to our audience, but just said, okay, we still feel like we're on strong footing. We're going to go ahead. And that's the decision that they make, which is the one you live with. I know had it been me similarly situated, I might want to sleep on it for a minute. I might want to take it all in. I might want to let this digest. And I might want to maybe even return to Judge Dugan and say, hey, can we have a chat about this? Because we don't want something like this to happen again. And we may very well end up in your courthouse again. It may be worth it to reach out to the judiciary and start opening up these lines of communication as opposed to rolling through like a bulldozer.
They didn't want that. They wanted the bulldozer. They wanted the media attention. They wanted the headlines. They wanted the perp walk.
Yeah, but it's 60 seconds, right? Yeah, it's 60 seconds of this. And then when you find out that it's just not going to work out, then what? When are we going to invite Judge Dugan to come talk to us when she's acquitted?
let me bring up just a couple of other things before we wrap this up. And that is, again, as a member of the media, I'm got to be critical of the news media on this. I don't know how many stories I have read in researching this that have said that Judge Dugan, when she was in practice before she took the bench, represented poor people and represented the downtrodden and all of this kind of remarks that I'm going, yeah, but what kind of judge is she? You're trying to say that because she represented poor people when she was in private practice, that all of a sudden she's going to do something illegal that jeopardizes her career on behalf of Mr. Ruiz? That's a leap to me, especially when
she's biased.
Especially when it says that he was in her courtroom on three charges of assault and she handled that properly and she's a judge that goes by the book. Why do you have to put in that she represented the poor and the downtrodden as a private attorney?
And you know why? Because this is not a federal judge where you could say she was appointed by such and such a president. Because
yeah, I think same
the media
difference.
Has done a poor job of really framing the judiciary, no matter when it is. I mean, I was speaking to a group last week and I indicated to them, this is the first time I think in my lifetime and in my career where I just regularly, I expect it now. Anytime I hear the name of a federal judge, I am naturally expecting there to be a comma, and I'm expecting to then read the name of the president who
Reagan appointee, Trump appointee.
Yes.
Obama appointee.
Yes. As if the decision of the judge must somehow be tethered, tied, or connected to the political leanings of the individual who appointed them or who nominated them, which for our audience's benefit, that is exactly the antithesis of what any judge would like for you to think of them, or at least most judges, unless you're just kind of aspiring some kind
to
of way.
To further that point, Judge, we also get a judge appointed by Trump ruled against the Trump administration.
So, and as they should, if it is the right thing to do.
Exactly. That's not news.
We had Judge Chutkan in D.C., which there are so many who were like, yes, she's an Obama appointee. She's going to stick it to the Trump administration. Well, that didn't, ask Jack Smith. That didn't happen at every single stage. It didn't happen every single step. And Judge Chutkan, Judge Howell, there are so many judges who have issued rulings that have maybe not been the ones that, you know, those in their political party would have preferred, but they are in line with what the law requires and what it allows and what is expected. Again, what you have are judges, not puppets. And I think that's also what the problem is here. When it comes to Judge Dugan, the problem is that, hey, you can't connect her back to a federal official to have appointed her. So what's the next best thing? Oh, well, we'll look at her background. We'll look at her history.
She represented poor people.
Yes. And we'll create a picture, which
a narrative.
Is so very unfair. We'll create a picture or a narrative, or we'll suggest that she harbors an innate bias in favor of people who are poor or disadvantaged or alleged to have, you know, to be, you know, from minority
immigrants.
Groups.
Immigrants.
Anything. Yeah. Yeah, maybe she's the DEI judge. I don't know. But at the end of the day, it is such an offense to someone like you and I, who as former judges, yeah. We understand our how sincerely, how deeply, and how committed our colleagues are to their oaths of office. And these have nothing to do with the work that they did before. I mean, we've talked about it before, but Judge, I don't think you've ever said, and I know that I haven't, that, hey, listen, you know, you were, you know, a former defense attorney, but you know what? You happily took that persona with you when you put your robe on every day. I was a former prosecutor. I think I was harder on prosecutors than anybody. Because
I was harder on defense attorneys because I didn't want people to think I was biased one way or the other. You know, you have to go by the book to shed that public perception.
Yes. And it is so important because I taught this course just a few short weeks ago to some judges while we were talking about what feels like the very heavy lift, the awesome burden of reinfusing faith in our justice system, restoring this faith. There's, you know, whether it's this administration or anybody else, there was already this winnowing faith in the system of justice. Folks have seen for themselves how they believe there's one system in place for the advantaged versus the disadvantaged. And there's so many of us judges that are working so hard to help to ensure and to remind and to reaffirm to a public that one thing I will say, Director Patel said that no one is above the law. No one is above the law. So everyone is being held equally accountable, but at the same time, we don't have to disparage each other. We can find better ways, especially when we all have common goals of upholding the rule of law. We don't have to purposely seek ways to embarrass, disparage, or you know, to mistreat each other in this process. And that's why I'll continue to say, in my view, I just think perhaps the response here to Judge Dugan was pretty heavy-handed because I think it lacked the real pause that's necessary to synthesize all of the evidence and information. And maybe, and you know what? The other thing is, Judge, we have to admit that there may be some facts and some information that we don't know yet that has
Sure there is. We've gone through, reading Milwaukee Journal, the yes. New York Times, various legal publications. So we're gathering the facts as
they are available. Yes.
You know, but there may be other factors. One last thing that I want to talk about real quick. We've only got a couple of minutes, so let's try to make this quick. And that is this case going to go to trial? And if so, how soon?
I think you heard me say earlier is that, you may have an AG and a FBI director that is insistent on digging in. And they may or may not be armed with all of the legal standing that they need to make an intelligent decision. If this is purely political, and if it is designed to make a point and to also solidify more of a chilling effect, then yeah, it's going to go to trial. Because I think you'll have a Judge Dugan on the other side with a very learned legal team that says, you know what, this is, it's wrong on so many levels. It's wrong on a personal and moral level, but it's also wrong legally. And there's no, again, that three-legged stool has two of the three legs as wobbly. So this stool can't stand. But I think you might, and it might be pretty quick.
My position is that this is going to drag out and that it's not going to go to trial because I think that when they look at this with the sober light of day, that the government, the U.S. government, the AG's office, the FBI, are going to say there is potential on this for not guilty. There is potential on this to make bad law from their perspective. So we're going to drag this out as long as we can, and then it's either going to disappear or we're going to have some resolution short of a trial. We cannot bear going to trial on this and losing.
The only part about that I will agree on you is that, yes, it does have the potential to be a not guilty and or to make really bad law that maybe some folks won't be happy with. But remember, it's the defendant's call. The defendant has speedy trial rights. The defendant has the right to determine if they want a jury or a bench trial. The defendant has a right to either ask for discovery or not, which can be a time tolling event. And so it's not. This is not within the government's control. I don't even think they have enough levers to cause this thing to drag out. But instead, you're going to have a Judge Dugan who's going to be eager to get back on the bench and to be exonerated.
We didn't mention that. The Supreme Court of Wisconsin has suspended Judge Dugan, not taken her off the bench, but suspended her being on the bench while this is pending.
Correct.
She still has her judgeship, but she's not sitting while this is pending.
And she's going to want to be vindicated. So I don't agree. And there aren't too many things that we don't agree on, but I don't agree that the government is going to be able to drag this out, because I think you're going to have a very aggressive defendant that is not going to take this lying down and is not going to stand for any gamesmanship from the federal government and say, if you think you got the goods, then bring it. If you don't, then dismiss it and drop it. And you better hope I don't ask for a public apology. That's what I think you're going to see. Otherwise, she's going to say box it up, which I don't know that I'd blame her.
One other thing, there is going to be aggressive motion practice in this case. And what I mean by that for our listeners is that there are all kinds of motions that happen prior to a trial, both civil and criminal, that the judge hearing the case must decide. Some of the cases that we talked about will come up, I'm sure, in motion practice by the defense to try to get the case dismissed prior to a trial.
Yep. And I think you're going to have a lot of motion practice. And if you don't see a federal government prepared to essentially, I think they're going to call for a flat out dismissal. They're going to want these charges dismissed. Then I think you're going to see a defense that feels so comfortable in their position legally that they are going to say, okay, give us a trial. And they very well may ask for a bench trial instead of a jury.
And that would be in front of a federal judge.
And they're going to argue, this could be you next, judge.
How do people listen to us?
Well, folks can catch us on a myriad of ways. We are honored and excited, and we have a clear dedication to our primary partner, National Public Radio, or NPR. So you can catch us on NPR, Apple, Spotify, or Amazon, or anywhere you catch your favorite podcasts. We invite you to come check us out, because as we decode this for you, we like to say, you don't trust what you don't understand. Our goal is to help you to understand what is happening in the hopes that you will trust us more.
And if you want to suggest a program for us to talk about or a topic for us to talk about, please shoot me an email. You can do that at Hodson, H-O-D-S-O-N, at ohio.edu. That's Hodson at ohio.edu. In fact, the program that we just finished was one suggested by listeners. So please, we take your suggestions to heart, and we try to deliver for you. Next Witness, Please is produced through WOUB Public Media. Colin Cameron is our co-producer and audio engineer. And Judge Gale and I will be back real soon to give you more insights into the law. Until then, have a good day, everyone.
Take care, folks.